Okay, welcome back, folks. Jeff Sachs here, live from Mishkan Sipor in Efrat. It's Masechet Kiddushin. Baruch Rofei Cholim. Ruining his perfect attendance record.
No, establishing his perfect attendance.
Well, we started last week with a lengthier than necessary introduction to Masechet Kiddushin, some of the themes. And we began learning the Gemara on Daf Mem Aleph, Omer Aleph 41a. There's source sheets going around, but not the Gemara itself. The Gemara is still the Gemara begins with this discussion of a person can affect Kiddushin, meaning you can marry a woman directly or through the emissary, a shaliach, can deliver, let's say, simplest case, you appoint an emissary, you appoint a shaliach, you give him a ring and say, go over, find Rachel, and be makadesh her on my behalf, betroth her on my behalf, right? And the shaliach goes, the messenger goes, and he gives the ring to Rachel in front of two witnesses. And even though they're not in the same room, maybe not even in the same country, Rachel is now his lawfully wedded arusa, his betrothed. And the bride, similarly, can accept the kiddushin like we do under the chuppah, where he puts the ring on the finger. What we've seen at every Jewish wedding we've ever either participated in or witnessed. Right, that's the way it's done. Or she could send a shaliach. Like, I can imagine the wedding that we just made last month. Let's say the bride couldn't make it for some reason. She was busy that night. So she sent her brother, who's a very lovely fellow. Whether a woman can be a shliach for these purposes, the Gemara is going to get to. But if she sends her brother, brother's a very lovely guy. But I find it hard to imagine now, looking at the pictures that we just got of my son standing under the chuppah, giving the ring to his kala's brother. He could have sent his brother also. It could have been two brothers. We discussed last week the marriage of Ferdinand and Isabella, which was done in this way. So the Gemara says that, nevertheless, this probably shouldn't be done if the husband has never met the wife, has never seen the wife, because this is just by way of review, because, you shouldn't marry somebody unless you've seen her. The chance of being disappointed with a mail order bride is much greater than if you made the choice kind of with the knowledge that you gain by actually. No, this is a myth that that Charedim or that Tevye's daughters got married and they didn't meet each other until after the chuppah, because under the chuppah she had. Yeah. It's not true that you meet for 10 minutes and the next time you meet each other is on the wedding night. This is a myth, right? This is a myth. I mean, we've all seen Shtisel, right? We know that this is a myth, right? It's true that they don't date for 5 years, right? But it's a myth that the people that arranged marriages, even in the ultra Orthodox world, are done in such a fashion. But the Gemara says it's not proper to marry somebody, even though if you do marry somebody, you send a shaliach. You heard there's a nice girl in the next town, you never met her, right? You send a shaliach and say, hey, I have a friend back home. Here's the ring. He wants to marry you. Lama'aseh, she's mikudeshet. Lama'aseh, halachically, they're married. But the Gemara says this is not proper. This should not be done, because maybe he'll discover that she's not everything he'd heard about, since he wasn't able to judge for himself. The picture on what's it called, J-Date? The picture on J-Date was... Yeah, I saw you at Sinai, right? But since Sinai, you've gained a little weight, you lost some hair.
Didn't see you at Sinai.
Nice, at Sinai you were much younger, but now... Look, I have a friend. I have a friend who was in the market for a wife, having lost his previous wife to divorce. So he got on those websites right away. It's been a long time since he was in the dating market. His hairline, had gone for a trip. His waistline as well. He puts a picture up. He shows me his profile. I said to him, honesty in advertising is required. This was a picture from like college or something. So this such things happen. So the Gemara says, if you marry a girl without seeing her, you may come to transgress. What will you transgress? Love your neighbor as yourself. You shouldn't go into a situation where you're going to end up disliking someone, let alone worse. Right? There are worse emotions sometimes that come out in a bad marriage. Right? So because there's a chance that you're not going to like what you get, sight unseen, you shouldn't do that. But the Gemara does not assume that that applies in the reverse direction. Because a man can be Mekadesh, a woman with a Shaliach, and technically, even if he's never seen her, it would work, but you shouldn't do that. But the Gemara doesn't flip it. The Gemara doesn't say, the Gemara explicitly says the opposite. The Gemara says, but however, she can make a Shaliach to accept the ring, but there's no problem of her doing it sight unseen. He saw her, you know, through the one-way mirror or something, but she doesn't know what he looks like or what he is like or what his virtues are or character are. But there's no problem there. Why aren't we afraid she's going to come to dislike him? No. So the Gemara says, Tav lemetav tandu milametiv armav. Right? A woman, all things being equal, prefers to be married, even in a less desirable marriage, than to be alone. So she will not come to dislike him. I mean, even if she dislikes him, she won't violate ve'ahavta rechah kamocha, because she prefers the situation as it is. Now, this idea, this is where we left off last week. Tav lemetav tandu milametiv armalu, which literally means marav is. Oh, he's welcome to join. Literally means it is better for two to dwell together than for the woman, that is, to be a widow or to be alone, to be a spinster, an old maid, as they used to say. This is very obviously to our modern ears. You have to speak up so people online can hear. We're going to try to, folks online, we're going to set up here a microphone system where you'll be able to hear.
I wanted to bring a copy of the Silent Teshuva that I came across. It was referred to me some years back, in which I believe this concept was recruited in order to, as part of the argument, saying that a particular woman could not have an annulment. And I regret that I am not more familiar with it.
I'm sorry, I forgot your name.
Elliot Shevin.
Elliot.
So, I mean, Elliot is referring to a case. I sent you this rather well-known statement of Rabbi Soloveitchik from 1975. By the way, you know, there's this WhatsApp group. If you're not on the WhatsApp group, you should get on the WhatsApp group. Who's in charge of the WhatsApp group? You? See, it's me afterwards. And the folks online, there's a link from the webpage where you can join the WhatsApp group where things sometimes get circulated around. But Soloveitchik had an idea. You and I started discussing this, David, during the week. But Soloveitchik had an idea, which is no less, let's say, difficult to understand to some modern sensibilities. The idea that a woman prefers a bad marriage than being alone might be easy for us to understand if it's explained as a kind of reflection of a sociological reality of antiquity. It was Chazal's point of view, but the question is, why did Chazal come to this view? So you want to say that it's a sociological reality. Yeah. So Rabbi Soloveitchik did not ascribe to that himself, did not align himself with that view. He didn't think it was sociological. He thought it was ontological, meaning, speaking in 1975, after the rise of the feminist movement, after the rise of the efforts to pass the ERA. He says, no, this is ontological, meaning it's baked into creation. But this is part of the feminine. He didn't use the term feminine mystique, but this is part of the feminine makeup. Now, he was doing this in response, Elliot. This is what you were referring to a position that was advanced by Rabbi Emanuel Rachman, who later came to become the president. here at Bar Ilan and lived to a ripe old age. Rabbi Rachman had advanced efforts for Hafka'at Kiddushin, to annul marriages that went bad, but where a woman could not otherwise receive a get. Rabbi Soloveitchik was very disturbed by this position. This is not a position which is well accepted, of annulling marriages in order to save women from the very, very lamentable situation of igun, of being stuck as abandoned wives. But this is a reflection of Rabbi Soloveitchik's kind of philosophy of halacha. Now, David, you said something to me in our correspondence about Madodech Medot, his other essay about the kind of shape and meaning and form and function of halacha. So what did you say there?
It's not only it's in a number of places. The Rabbi Soloveitchik's approach to halacha is that it's immune to external considerations and forces. He mentions this in Halachic Man. He mentions this in almost in every essay you can find that he writes, where he touches on halacha at all, even in some of the non-halachic essays. But he basically says that it's the most extreme position of this is an essay called Ma'ariv Dechmidot, a eulogy for his uncle, Yitzchak Zev Soloveitchik. And in that he compares he lays out his grandfather's approach to halacha, Rav Chaim, says it's very similar to Kant's approach to philosophy. And in both, he says that halacha is like a science, it's like mathematics, in the same way that 2 plus 2 equals 4 for you, 2 equals 4 for me, it can never change. And it always, that's the way it always goes. No historical, psychological, or sociological considerations can affect the halacha. And there he gives a mashal, a very famous mashal of a satellite. He said that when the satellite is launched into orbit, there could be any number of reasons and the path why it's launched up. But once it's up in orbit, it is completely independent of any earthly considerations in its revolutions around the earth. And that is the nature of halacha. So he's saying, in other words, in this, a lot of people, there was a lot of criticism of this essay, Ma'arudech Midot, about it being, not reflective, or maybe it was just a not a straw man, but it was like a hypothetical situation. But in this 1975 address to the RCA, he discussed this in terms of practical halacha. He says, this is exactly what you're talking about against Rabbi Rachman's approach. He's saying that the idea that the woman's situation, sociological situations or psychological considerations could be different now than they were when Chazal made this announcement thousands of years ago is not possible. And therefore, because since the halacha is by its nature, just like math and science is immune to historical and sociological and psychological considerations, then it has to be that way. And that's why there's no, that's why it has to be a scientific consideration. It's ontological, it's scientific. In what you quoted, he talks about it being going back to learning it from Bereishit Perek Bet. I mean, it's something that was built into creation. It's like the halacha itself was built into creation. So that I think is kind of a proof. This, the 1975 speech was sort of a proof to those people who want to say that, no, Ma'arudech Midot doesn't represent what the Rav really believed in halacha. It's kind of difficult to say.
But I'm not sure that that's correct. In other words, the halacha is objective. Right?
Words, if the halacha is objective, so then 2 plus 2 always equals 4, right? And the reality of the feminine mentality is preference for marriage rather than solitude. And even though that's learned out from it's a statement about psychology, it's not affected by psychology.
The statement was kind of a pure statement of halacha, which basically what they were saying is they weren't saying that this is only applicable in a time when women were more dependent on, they couldn't get by on their own. He didn't say that had to be eternal.
Yeah.
And so that the Rav wouldn't say that. We might say that was a sociological truth in the times of the Tanaim, and it's not a sociological truth today, but the Rav would disagree with that approach. The question is how you read this statement of Chazal. Read it as something that was true then is possibly no longer true now. Or do you say that, no, any statement has to be true eternally? That's what the Rav was saying.
Well, generally speaking, yeah. Okay. No, so you're explaining why you think Rabbi Soloveitchik was wrong. You're giving sociological reasons. He says that's irrelevant. That's not the reason.
But the Rav is saying such and such is the actual built-in nature of women. They prefer company.
It's independent of the sociology. In all cases,
my objection would be, but why do you make that part of halakha?
No, in other words, because there are, in our case, there are halakhic ramifications of being able to say, had she known this, she would have never gotten married.
Had she known what?
Had she known that her husband was rotten?
Well, in the case of speaking of bringing, had I known he was Meshumak.
Yeah, in other words, there are all types of cases which we're going to encounter later in the perek of conditional marriage. If I get married because I think the person is rich, and it turns out that they're not rich, is that a condition that is a mekach tot? It's a false situation, and therefore it's right? It's true. So if you sell me a car, you say this is a great car. It's a perfect. You kick the tires, right? And I buy the car. You take my money. And the car doesn't have an engine. I don't mean it's going to break down in 100 kilometers. It doesn't have an engine. There's nothing under the hood. So then it's a mekach tos. And we say the sale is canceled. You have to return my money to me. So which kind of conditions? Anybody who's ever bought a used car knows that there's some degree of mekach tos, right? Not every disparity between what the buyer hopes and what the seller knows causes the sale to be canceled. And that's the field in which halacha jumps in and has to put a line and say, more than this is mekach ta'ut, it's a false sale, and less than that is, the kind of rounding errors that we all are prepared to live with. So in a conditional marriage, what makes a condition? So the Gemara says that basically in most cases, if the husband says that he's X and it turns out that he's less than X, the marriage still stands because of tavla metav tandu. All things being equal, the woman knows that she'd rather be married to even something she didn't expect than what she got. It's a halachic. It's not just a psychological statement or sociological statement. It has halachic consequences of whether or not we would void this marriage. For example, whether or not we allow her to get married without having sight unseen. Or not. There's halachic ramifications for this. I don't want to dwell on this particular point, but neither was it proper to lay this egg of tavla metav tandu and just pass it by without making reference to it and acknowledging that indeed it is a difficult phenomenon. The Gemara says mitzvah bo yoter mi bishlucho. The reason that you're able to you're allowed to get married through a shaliach, either his shaliach or her shaliach or both. But all things being equal, it's always preferable to do the mitzvah yourself. So for the husband, okay, mitzvah boyo, the husband is obligated to get married. Why the husband is obligated to get married? Most Rishonim say that a man's obligation to get married is because that is the avenue towards fulfilling the mitzvah puruvu of being fruitful and multiplying. Now, oddly, even though, as we all know, either because we have children or we have wives or we all had mothers, God knows we all had mothers, and some of you online, of course, are mothers yourself. God knows that in childbirthing, the women do the heavy lifting, literally. The women do the hard work. Nevertheless, the Gemara says that the obligation of bringing children into the world is incumbent upon the man and not upon the woman. The Gemara in Yevamot says that that women are pturot from puruvu. Now, it might be that they're not obligated in the mitzvah of bringing children into the world because, again, it might be, one might say that this is a reflection of Chazal's idea that one needn't obligate someone in something that they have such a natural proclivity to in all cases. One needn't obligate. There's certain things that you're not obligated to.
The opposite.
Coming from the other direction is that they're not obligated because it's not reasonable to obligate, even though in reality, most women do want to have most humans want to have children. right? We consider it a rather sad situation when someone is unable to have children, man or woman. But since childbirth is a serious undertaking, and even today, when it's a lot safer than it used to be, until, you know, very recent human history, it was a very perilous situation for women and not for men. And therefore, it has to be something that's done voluntarily. We can't obligate a woman to put herself into that situation. And therefore they're patrot. So when we say mitzvah bo yoter mi bishlucho, that all things being equal, the woman should be involved in the kiddushin herself rather than sending a messenger boy to do it. What mitzvah, what does it mean? Her mitzvah is greater if she does it on her own. She doesn't have a mitzvah.
Capital M mitzvah?
Oh.
Like, she has to do it. If you're going through the process, you have to do it according to Lacha, and that's therefore it's a mitzvah. You know, you have a mitzvah, how do you do it?
No, so,
digging. You have to, there's an obligation to do digging.
So again, most Rishonim think that the Masek Dushin is a mitzvah that a man fulfills. It's a mitzvah that might be ancillary
you
to.
Yourself last week said, you mentioned the brachot under the Talmud.
Most Rishonim count it as a chuppah as a mitzvah. Not everyone, right? Not everyone.
Would the mitzvah be the action of becoming married, or the actual action of handing over the ring?
I think it means the chuppah v'kiddushin. This ceremony constitutes a mitzvah, right? The same way that lahavdil. Everybody agrees. Many years ago, we learned the second gift, right? Everyone agrees, as bizarre as it is, right? The act of giving a divorce is a mitzvah. There's no bracha recited, but there's plenty of mitzvot where we don't recite brachot. You can understand why it's not such a happy occasion if you want to recite a bracha. Right? But this act of giving the get to the wife is a mitzvah, right? It's a mitzvah taseh, like shaking a lulav, like hearing the shofar. Right, we don't think of it in that way, but it's a mitzvah, right? I mean, I remember the fellow who put his youthful picture on the J-date. I was there when they gave the get. I was in the betin when he divorced his wife that put him back on the market. I had never actually witnessed a get before, but it's the mirror image of what I described last week, right? That a kiddushin, it changes. It there's this metaphysical change. A minute earlier, she was a man's wife, and the next minute, she's a penuya, right? This mystical bond between them is somehow severed. So everybody agrees that that act of giving the get is a mitzvah. So the act of the opposite direction, according to most Rishonim. So what mitzvah is it? So the Ran says that even though she's not obligated in Puravu, Like all matters where you help somebody, it takes two to tango, right? In Puravu, I mean, even with different scientific and medical advances, it takes two to tango. Puravu requires both man and woman, and at least in the conventional sense, and therefore her involvement constitutes at least an assist on the mitzvah enough to count towards mitzvah bo yoter mi bishlucho. The sheet, there's a rishon on Masechet Kiddushin, which you may not have heard of, but the name will come up from time to time as we're learning. It only appears in Kiddushin. It's called, sometimes it's just called the Shita, or it's sometimes called the Shita lo noda lemi, the unknown position, right? It's an anonymous, it's a commentary on Masechet Kiddushin, which is ascribed to one of the students of the Rashba, right? The Rashba, late 13th century Spain, student of the Ramban. So this anonymous Rishon on Masechet Kiddushin, the Shita Lo Noda Lemi, the anonymous author of this thing, was apparently from that Beit Midrash, from that school of the Rashba. So he says, quite simply, that just the Peseder, women are Pturot, they're exempt. But like all of the mitzvot that women are peturot from, that they're exempt from, with very few exceptions, women are not only allowed to participate, but they're encouraged to participate. Women are technically peturot, are exempt from the mitzvah of shofar, because it's a mitzvah to say shazman grama. in the past, we've spoken about the fact that this exemption for women from time-bound positive mitzvot is actually, there are more exceptions to the rule than there are times we invoke the rule. But in principle, women are patrioed from time-bound positive mitzvot, unless it's one of the exceptions, many exceptions to the rule. But even the time-bound positive mitzvot that they are patrioed from, like sitting in the sukkah, waving the lulav, blowing the shofar, right? They're encouraged to take these things on. And if they do, at least for Ashkenazim, they say a bracha. They say, Asher kideshanu mitzvotav v'tzivanu leishev basuka. Even though they're exempt, they're able to say, nevertheless, I'm commanded. If I do it, it's a mitzvah for me. Right? And in many cases, these voluntaristic acts have taken on almost the full force of obligatory acts. But technically, women are exempt from shofar, but you don't hear women saying, I don't have to go. I mean, if they say that, it's for other reasons. Right? There's some men who say that as well. Right? but generally speaking, women who are within the world of keeping mitzvot are very careful to hear the shofar. Right? They're even careful to eat in the sukkah. Right? They're careful to. They should be careful. I mean, we should all educate our daughters, some of us now granddaughters, to take the lulav every day of sukkahs, right? So that's the idea that they are. There is another position that in fact no women are women might be patrioed from puravu for either this reason or that reason, but they're obligated in getting married. Even though marriage, what's the song? Love and marriage, horse and carriage. Right? And then comes the baby and the baby carriage. So like, you know, things tend to lead one to the other. And even though women are technically patriot from puravu procreation, nevertheless, they are obligated in kiddushin, because kiddushin kind of saves everybody from the lamentable situation of not being able to enjoy the pleasures of marital love, the physical love, etc. The other interesting thing we saw last week, before we get back to the Gemara, is the source for mitzvah bo yoter mibishlucho. There are only two places, even though this principle of all things being equal, it's better to do it yourself rather than have somebody do it for you. There are really only two places in Chazal where it's invoked, even though it kind of becomes a global desideratum. One is Kiddushin. The other is, no, not Kiddushin. The other is Kavod Shabbos. And the Gemara brought examples of Amoroyim who were careful to do, even though they were holy rabbis and, you know, holy, I can tell you from personal experience. Holy rabbis spend the whole day learning Torah. We don't get involved in those types of things. Cooking and cleaning and all that other type of stuff around us. My wife wouldn't hear of it. Why are you laughing?
It's your manner.
I was looking for his response.
It's the way our wives were raised. The way those sisters were raised. But seriously, folks. The people online have to get to know my sense of humor. It'll come, but it takes some people sitting around the table, been here a few years, they still don't get it. So what's this connection between marriage and Shabbos? So last week, David actually mentioned a few nice ideas. You could check the recordings for that. But look at the Rambam here. Here's the Rambam at the top of the page. First of all, this is the Rambam in Hilchos Shabbos, Perek Lamed, chapter 30. Halacha Hey is an idea that we mentioned last week, which is not directly related, but it's worth reviewing. Mesader Adam Shulchano be'erev Shabbat. The preparations for Shabbat should all be done on, ideally on Erev Shabbat. And I mentioned last week, sometimes in the short winter Shabbatot, when Shabbat starts at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, it's sometimes hard to get it all done. And last Friday, darn it, I said, I just taught this halacha, we have to be careful about it. And of course, the train came off the tracks in our house, and we came home Friday night, and the dishes were still piled in the sink, and the table wasn't set, and you know, the bed was covered in the unfolded laundry and all of these other things. But the halacha is that's not the way you're supposed to go into Shabbat, right? The halacha says Misada Adam Shulchano be'erev Shabbat. You should set the table on Friday afternoon. Va'afal pisha enot sarach ela lekazayit, right? Even if you only have to eat a little bit, we eat a lot on Shabbos, right? But let's say it's just you and the missus, the kids, you're empty nesters, right? You don't have guests. Right, so like there's a temptation. Well, you know, we'll eat on the folding table in the kitchen. We'll just put out a placemat. No, it's not proper. You should set the table nice for Shabbat. V'chein mesada shulchano b'motzei Shabbat, and motzei Shabbat you also have the malav malk. We'll skip that, right? In order to honor the Sabbath at its coming in and at its going out. The tzarich l'takein beito mibaod yom mipnei kavod Shabbat, and in order to honor the Sabbath, everything in the house should be clean and neat and organized before candlelighting. Your candles should be lit, your table should be set, your bed should be made. And their beds, of course, were different than ours. Remember the Murphy beds? Like in small apartments, the bed would like fold up into the wall, right? And like, you know, you'd when it was taught, or like, you know, people like live in a small apartment, have like a fold-out bed, right? So like normally we unfold the bed like right before you go to sleep. Right? But that's not that. I hate that. I hate like going to get into bed and discovering like the bed isn't made. I think when you get into bed at night, the bed should be made.
Yeah.
Right? If you make your bed in the morning, it should still be made in the evening. I hate that. Like if I get into bed and I see like the kids have been jumping on my bed and the bed's all messed up. Right. And I'll make the, I'm such a OCD yucky like this. I'll make the bed before I get into my wife said, what are you making the bed? You're about to get into it. I said, no, it's not the same. It's not the same. You get in at night, the sheets are all crisp and neat, right? But that's so, because what do you want to do on Friday night? You want to eat a nice meal. It should be ready to go, right? You want to have a nice schluff. The bed should be ready to go. Right? And all of this is within the parameters of Kavod Shabbat, of honoring the Sabbath. Now, the next halacha is what's interesting for us. Af al pi sheyeh adam chashuv biyoter. And even though a person might be very important guy, he doesn't go to Rami Levi, right? You know who goes to the supermarket? You ever go to the supermarket and meet important people? No. They have people that do things for them. And he's not involved in housekeeping chores. Avner Baruchi, yeah. So even though he doesn't normally involve himself with the household chores, chayav lasot dvarim shehen l'tzarech Shabbat begufo. Nevertheless, he has to personally be involved in the preparations for Shabbat. Shezehu kvodo. Because this is the honor of the Sabbath. Or Shizehu, what's the antecedent of Kvodo?
Him.
Either it's his honor or it's the Sabbath's honor.
Not Shabbat, the Kiva.
No, it can go either way. Amim Arishonin, and then he cites our Gemara and other Gemaras, the earlier rabbis, Mehen Bishayo Minat. Some people would chop the wood to make the kindling to light the fire, and others would do the cooking, or moleach basar, would salt the meat, or godel ptilot, or would prepare the wicks. You know, it's not like us. Our candle lighting is pretty easy. Oh, madlik neirot, or they would light the candle. This is not madlik neirot for neirot Shabbat, but like on Friday. If you wanted any light in the house, it had to be done.
Like Shabbos
clocks. So today you'd be setting the Shabbos clocks, right? Umehen misha haya yotzei v'koned varim shein l'tzarech Shabbat. They'd go out to the shuk, they'd go out to the marketplace to buy the Sabbath provisions, v'machal u'mashke, food and drink, af al pi she'ein darko b'kach. Even though normally, they'd never go on a Sunday, but on Friday, they go because that's honoring Shabbat. V'chol hamarbe b'davar ze hare ze meshubach. And the more the merrier. The more you do, the better. So the It's getting late, so I don't want to do it on the inside. But here you see this. The Shulchan Aruch brings this as a halakha. The Shulchan Aruch brings this as a halakha. It says, Yishtadeh lehachin ba'atzmo shum davar l'tzorchei Shabbat kedei lechabdo. How does the Shulchan Aruch read the Rambam? What's the antecedent of lechvodo? The Shabbat. But the Shulchan Aruch understands it's not that the man does these things and it's an honor for the man to do it. No. The man does these things, and by doing these things, by doing the shopping and the cleaning and the cooking, he is honoring the Sabbath. And then the Shulchan Aruch brings other examples of Amoroyim that did these types of things. The Be'ur Halacha, which is the second commentary of you know about the Mishnah Berurah, right? The Chafetz Chaim. The Chafetz Chaim wrote two commentaries. He wrote the Mishnah Berurah, and he wrote the Be'ur Halacha. The Be'ur Halacha is a little more expansive. So the Be'ur Halacha asks a question. He says there's a stira here. There's a contradiction. The contradiction is that a Talmid Chacham is exempt. An Adam Gadol, an important person, a Talmid Chacham, is exempt from doing certain things that will cause him bizayon. That will cause him to be... disgrace, right? So, for example, Hashavat Aveda, it's an important mitzvah, right? If you find a lost object, you have to return it to somebody. So, let's say you're an important person. Right? You're, I don't know. Wait a second. Let's say you're an important person, and you know the halachot about how a Talmid Chacham has to dress. The Gemara says, the Rambam brings it lahalacha, that if a Talmud Chacham goes out of the house and he's got schmutz on him, let's assume it means schmutz, like you were eating a sandwich and you got a little mayonnaise here, right? You're chayav misa. You're like, heaven will zap you. Why? Because a Talmud Chacham, a Torah scholar, is the ambassador for God, for Torah. So you have to look the part, right? You have to, it's not proper to walk around looking schmutzy. Because you are an ambassador for Torah. You misrepresent, you cast a bad reputation on the Torah. So let's say you're walking along and you see somebody's, Gemara talks about a little sheep. And so that's Hashavat Aveda. You have to return the lost sheep. So how do you carry a sheep?
Over your shoulders.
You know what sheep smell like? They don't smell nice. You know what sheep do on you while you're carrying them over the shoulders? It's not nice. So the Gemara says, a Talmid Chacham, in a case like that, the Talmid Chacham is patur, he's exempt from the mitzvah of returning this lost object. Because it would cause him to be a certain level of disgrace. But the Talmid Chacham, he's Amorayim, they go out to the market. You know what it's like in Shuk Machane Yehuda on Friday? Right? That's a bizayon. Everybody's pushing and everybody's shoving and you're haggling with people. And I mean, it's nice. You know, it's like one of those like things that whenever we go, you know, you say, this is Israel. Like, this is what we came in Aliyah for. But we don't do it every Friday. So how come for Shabbos, he's obligated? But for Shabbos Aveda, he's potter? What's the distinction? Do you see somebody walking along? Do you see someone walking? Remember Ariel Sharon? Was it a biography or an autobiography of Ariel Sharon when he was prime minister? Called Haro'eh, the Shepherd. You don't remember this? It was a very popular book. It was a biography of Ariel Sharon when he was prime minister, right? Ariel Sharon had his farm down in Chavat Shikmim. And the picture on the cover was Ariel Sharon. Ariel Sharon was a big guy. And he had a picture of like a sheep, like exactly like that, over his shoulders. You know, exactly what... Osh Mem Shelet Yisrael. Could you imagine Bibi doing that? You cannot imagine Bibi. You can't imagine Sarah letting him. Because she has an idea of what kavod is, of how you're supposed to look. So it's all contextual. Here it is sociological. This is a halakha which is sociologically defined. if it's clear that schlepping this beast on your shoulders is l'shem mitzvah, if somehow people knew that, maybe you'd hang a sign with the goats, instead of a bell, you'd hang a sign and say, lost goat on its way to fulfill a mitzvah of Hashavat Aveda. Then there's no bizayon, because there can't be a bizayon. There can't be a disgrace in doing a mitzvah taseh min haTorah. I like David dancing before the Torah. It's all contextual. And there, everybody agrees, even Rabbi Soloveitchik, that certain matters of kavod, right, are contextual. As a matter of fact, Rabbi Soloveitchik says this explicitly in Lonely Man of Faith. In Lonely Man of Faith, he says that dignity, Adam 1's search for dignity, is you can't, he says, Robinson Crusoe cannot live a dignified life, because living alone in isolation outside of community can afford you no dignity, because dignity is something that is socially constructed, right? Other people grant you honor and dignity, but living alone in a vacuum, you can never obtain it, no matter how you live your life. But Friday, you see a Talmid Chacham mopping doing the sponge. You know he's doing it for Kavod Shabbos. That's the beauty of Eretz Yisrael. Everybody. Rabbi Soloveitchik said in a different, in Ala Tshuva, he says Rabbi Soloveitchik says, describing the American scene in the 60s or 70s, that we've turned a corner on Shmirat Shabbat in terms of, people are, you know, Sabbath observance in America once upon a time was very touch and go. And even people who had 6 days a week. No, some people worked 7 days a week.
No, but I'm saying that.
The normal work week was 6 days a week. And there were plenty of people who were committed to mitzvot, but went to work on Shabbat because they felt, correctly or incorrectly, that if they didn't do that, it was life and death. If you don't work on Saturday, don't come on Monday. So in the 67th Rabbi Soloveitchik, we said we've begun to turn the corner on Sabbath observance. But what we do not observe, even the Shomrei Shabbat, don't observe Erev Shabbat. Why? For obvious reasons. I mean, whenever I've been to America, in all the years I'm living here, I never really lived as an adult in America. I never really had a career in America where, I mean, some of you remember this. Friday in the winter, my goodness, how they do this. I remember I've gone to, when our brother and sister, brother-in-law and sister lived in America, in Connecticut, if I was in America, I would often go there for Shabbat, and they both work hard, and, you know, November and December, they come home. I remember watching my sister-in-law, they come home 20 minutes, a half hour before Shabbat. She doesn't even take her coat off, right? She just getting the food in the oven and getting everything done and obviously Thursday night, they've done most of the work. Right, that's something we don't experience here. Even though somehow here, you know, it fills the preparations for Shabbat expand to fill the available time. So Rabbi Soloveitchik said, we have Shomer Shabbat, but we don't have Shomer Erev Shabbat. Now here in Eretz Yisrael, we have the opposite. Right, everybody here is Shomer Erev Shabbat. Right, Friday, everybody's doing sponge. Friday people buy flowers. They buy the newspapers. They buy pitzuchim and garidim, right? Everybody on the most chiloni person on the bus, on the radio, right, is saying, on the way to the beach, on the way to the movie, is saying Shabbat Shalom, right? Everybody knows that Friday afternoon has a different feel here. Not everybody in Machne Yehuda in the marketplace are going to be keeping Shabbat, but everybody's keeping every Shabbat. Right, and Shabbat itself, a lot of people keep Shabbat, a lot of people don't. It's a kind of irony of life here. Okay, so that's the Bior Halacha on that. I think we've gotten off track quite a bit because we haven't gotten back to the Gemara. So I'm going to skip this next piece and let's look at the Gemara. But it's interesting. These are interesting things to think about. So let's get back to the Gemara. We are in the middle of. Daf Mem Aleph Omud Aleph by the two dots. right? Hold on a second. Let me get this arrow here.
Yes, I think we're up to. I think we're up to. It is better to sit two bodies to sit together and be married.
So the Mishnah had said, "Ha'ish makadesh et bito kishinara." The third clause in the Mishnah says that a man can betroth his minor daughter, to another. He can marry off his minor daughter. Even though this is, of course, another idea which is a little troubling to our modern sensibilities. Kishinara in kishik tana lo. When she is a ne'ara in the 6 months between bat mitzvah and being 12 and a half, but when she's a ktana pre-bat mitzvah, lo. Messiah le l'rav. And this position that it cannot be done, a father marrying off his daughter before she turns 12, is a support for the position of rav. De omar rav Yehuda omar rav, V'itema Rabbi Elazar, and some say it was Rabbi Elazar, Asur la'adam shekadeshet bito kishehi ktana, ad shetigadel v'tomar b'ploni ani rotza. Right? That she cannot do this until she is old enough to form an opinion, right? To have some involvement in, but the idea being that before that point, she's too young.
Riska was particularly
young. So,
even there, she does say she consented to the marriage, but so that if she was younger and she still conceded with that.
So, in other words, so that's mi'un, that's if the brothers do it. That, in other words, there's a separate case, dirabanan, if there's no father died. There's a little girl. So the brothers who are there kind of in loco parentis can marry her off. Yeah, you can understand why in that world that we discuss there might be an interest in doing that so that she should be cared for, supported, etc. In that case, there's a concept called mi'un, where once she comes of age, she's able to nullify the marriage. Right, so she's able to protest and say, "No, I don't want this." And in that case, the wedding, because it wasn't a full proper halachic dioraita marriage, it was
father
a kind of.
Off when she's eight.
If the father married, miun is when there's only the brothers. Well, that's the position of Rav. That's the position of Rav, that he can't do it. So this is a Gemara. This Gemara is a support for that position. Okay. So now the Gemara asks, going on to a new topic here by the two dots. Shlichut menalan. Now this becomes a major sugya. We're going to spend a lot of weeks talking about this topic, and we're going to get into it for 5 minutes tonight, and then next week we'll just look at the Gemara. Where do you get this whole idea of shlichus? Where do you get this whole idea that you can point at an emissary to do certain things for you? Now, last week we talked about, obviously, you can't appoint a shaliach. Let me stay here. The word shaliach, which we'll be using again and again and again, I'm not going to translate it each time. But you understand we have people here from all different types of backgrounds of learning and expertise in halachic language. So let me just say here, shaliach means an emissary. We say shlucho shel adam kimoto. That in the cases when you're allowed to appoint an emissary, he is your extension. He is your long arm, right? If I have to mail a letter, right? Register for something, I have to mail a letter. The letter has to be postdated by a certain date for it to be valid. Postmarked. Do I have to go into the post office myself? Or if you're going there anyway, can you take the letter for me? You can take the letter for me. You're my shaliach. This is not a halachic matter, you understand, but it's the same idea, right? You are my long arm, right? To execute this act of getting the letter postmarked, right? Certain things, obviously, you can't make a shliach. We discussed last week tefillin. There's certain mitzvot that you have to do yourself. You can't outsource it to someone else. But the mitzvot or the acts that you're allowed to appoint a shliach, it's as if you did it yourself. It's as if you did it yourself. And Horaya, we all did this last Friday night. Unless you were all by yourself. Was anybody all alone last Friday night? No. All of you either made kiddush or heard kiddush. The person making the kiddush is a shaliach. Right? He's fulfilling through the mechanism of shomea ka'one, that a person, for most things, can listen and have intention, and it's as if we all said kiddush. Right? If it was just you and your wife around the table, you both are obligated in kiddush. Let me say something radical. Your wife could have said kiddush for you, and you'd be completely yotze. But as a matter of fact, you were both obligated that candles should be lit in your home. In most cases, the wife lights the candles and she's the shalicha for the man to get the job done. Right? So shlucho shel adam kimoto, and person's shaliach is an extension. Where does this idea of shlichut come from? Who says it works? What's the source for this idea? What? Well, in other words, so you point, it's interesting the Gemara doesn't suggest that. So I'm sorry, tell me your name.
Charles.
Avram Chaim Merrill.
Right.
Or Charles.
Charles.
Okay. What should we call you? Avram Chaim Merrill says, Merrill's your last name.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not like a Yiddish name.
No,
it's not like Shmerel. So Avram Chaim Merrill says that Avram sends the Eved, who the Midrash tells us is Eliezer, exactly to be a Shaliach, it's not
for Avram either.
It's not clear that he's a Shaliach for Kiddushin, right?
No,
he's a matchmaker, make me a match. Yeah, but he's not affecting the Kiddushin per se. But they're biblical antecedents of messengers and other things. It also just seems logical that, you know, like, what, in other words, the question would be, why wouldn't shlichut work? Right? And before you heard of the halachic concept of shlichut, you knew that the thing existed in the world. You've,
right? Looking
at it halachically, I mean, in that case, it was a question of finding somebody and bringing her back. But there are cases where the shaliach actually affects a change in the status, like for kedushin or for gitin.
Right.
Why would you assume that if I send somebody to hand over the get, that it's the same as if I did it?
And you have to ask, why does it work in any legal system?
I mean, we are aware that in other parallel legal systems, there's such a concept of power of attorney, for example. So the Gemara asks, Menalan Shlichut. Where Shlichut Menalan? Where does it come from? Titania, now here on the sheet, you have all these psukim. Let me go back to the sheet. Here. In Parshat Ki Teitse, we learn about marriage. Now, ironically, we learn about marriage piggybacked to divorce. Ki yikach ish isha uva'ala. When a man takes yikach. If we were learning the first parak, we would have spent a lot of time now these past 2 weeks talking about this one word. Kicha, lakachat. Marriage is called an act of acquisition. What? From Ephron, but in other words, but the kiddushin of kesef, that you give your wife money, usually in the form of a gold ring, but it's money nonetheless, and that woman becomes your wife through that mechanism of purchase. But again, clearly you'd have to define what it means to purchase. So ki ikach ish isha uvala, when a man takes a woman and has marital relations, v'haya im lo timtzachein be'enav, and he didn't like her. He found something objectionable about her. He writes her a bill of divorce, and he puts it in her hand. Veshilcha mi beito, and he sends her forth from his home. V'yatza mi beito, she leaves his home. V'halcha v'hayta l'ish acher, and she can now go and remarry somebody else. Wait a second.
All right.
Hold on. We were just reading a pasuk. Usnea ha'isha achron bekatav la sefer kritut. She's not so lucky in love. The second husband also writes her bill of divorce. V'natan biyada v'shilcha mi beito. And he also sends her from so. Oh, ki yamuta isha achron asher lakha lo li'isha. So either she gets out of marriage by divorce or by death. So the Gemara says, where vishilach milamed shehu oseh shaliach vishalcha milamed shehi oseh shaliach. Wait a second. So the Gemara is doing one of these al tikre type things, because it's not just vishilcha; it could be vishalcha. Right. In other words, there's a lot of shlichut going on here. Now, in the pasuk, you're correct, Elliot. The pasuk, the context means something else entirely. Right, it means to, but this the Gemara learns either as an asmachta, a kind of loose hook onto which to hang the idea. The Gemara learns this is the source. The Gemara is not done. There'll be lots of other suggestions put on the table, and then each of them will be debated back and forth. Right, but the first suggestion put on the table is the source for shlichut in kiddushin is ironically from the pasuk containing marriage, but we will leave you hanging on this cliffhanger, because obviously this is not the final word on the matter, and the Gemara will continue next week. Those of you online, I remind you that we pause now to have our veep in the shul, so we always have to kind of end abruptly. But of course, I'm always available to hear any comments or questions during the week. You can get me by email. So coming to you live from Mishkan Tzipora. Erev Tov.
Thank you.